This is the Medicast, November 12th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 92. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to take a moment and welcome all of you to the show this week. I will be talking about a lot of great stuff, tips and tricks, news, everything else coming right up. And those of you who've listened for a long time know what to expect. And I want to thank you for being continued subscribers to the show. And of course, for all of you brand new listeners, stick around, check out this episode, and then head on over to the medicast.com site. And you can check out all of the other past episodes in the podcast category. And also check out all the other posts I've put up on the blog, links to articles I think might be of interest to you, everything you might need to help you stay current on what's going on in EMS and medical news, all can be found over there at the medicast.com site. It's going to be a really busy week as I prepare for some travel during the United States Thanksgiving holiday, and I know a lot of you will be traveling as well, but I need to get a lot of things together so that I can keep putting out programming for you, and we'll be doing some of that over the coming week in the midst of everything else that I have going on, but I want to make sure that I keep the Medicast coming out on its regular schedule. So it will be still coming out despite the fact that I will be away a good bit over the next week, week and a half, and that will be on its normal Sunday night schedule. And I just want to make sure that you know that no matter what goes on, I'll try to have something out to you on a regular basis every single week. A lot of what helps out with that is all of the listener feedback and comments that I get, and all of that really helps me come up with new topics that you want to see covered, information and articles that you may find on the web that you think I might be interested in. Those links are always great to get. So let's jump in and take a look at some of the listener mail I got this week. First off, I got an email from listener Helen. Helen's a longtime listener from the Southern California area, and Helen is going to be helping to contribute to this coming Tuesday night's Medicast Live segment on Wilderness EMS. Even if she can't be there in person, she did send me a bunch of her thoughts, a collection of what she'd like to have said about being a Wilderness EMT. And Helen, thank you very much. I hope you're able to free up your schedule and attend Tuesday night's show. You can head over to medicastlive.com, which is hosted over at the talkshoe.com website. And all that information on how to sign up, free registration, and then you do a quick download of some extra browser software you'll need to just connect. And on Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern time, on the 13th of November, I will be hosting a live discussion on Wilderness EMS. What is Wilderness EMS? And what kind of things make it different from the type of EMS that I'm used to in my community? And this is all really open to whatever the listeners that call in bring to the table. I hope to have some of my regular guests, some other bloggers and podcasters involved in EMS that will be able to share their opinions and questions. But really, this is really something that relies very heavily on you, the listeners. So if you are a Wilderness EMT or have been a Wilderness EMT in the past, I'd really look forward to hearing what your comments are about that type of a program and what you think is the best way to approach being a Wilderness EMT. How do you become a Wilderness EMT? What you thought of the program you went through? Did you become certified? All of that we can look at on this Tuesday night's Medicast Live, which will be covering the topic of Wilderness EMS. Speaking of Wilderness EMS, I have a good friend of the show and a fellow podcaster that seems to have stumbled back in after being lost for a long time. I've gotten many emails over the past 6 or 7 months from a lot of you saying, hey, whatever happened to John Bignell of the EMS Live podcast? It seems like John dropped off the face of the earth. Well, a combination of things happened. John's been a podcaster and running the EMS Live internet radio program for a long time. And John also recently, his wife had a baby. So the combination of becoming a new parent and really needing to take a break from doing his show and reevaluate and make some changes in the formatting have all contributed to why John hasn't been around. But I have been in touch with him, and I think I said so a few months ago when I was asked the same question. And John just wanted to let me know that he is getting ready to reopen the EMS Live program with a new format. I think there's going to be some video involved. I don't have a lot of details, but my goal is once John's ready, I want to set up a phone interview with John, and we'll have all the details on his new programming. He's a great resource for all of us. And unlike what you might see on regular television, podcasters, and especially podcasters in the EMS realm, have all been very supportive of each other and will continue to be. So just because you listen to my show doesn't mean you can't go listen to John's. I certainly do, and I'm looking forward to what he has to offer. So John, thanks for sending me an email, and I will be looking forward to getting in touch with you and finding out more information about what you have planned in the coming weeks as you reopen EMS Live. I got a great email from listener Scott Stewart, who is an instructor in Australia for paramedics. And Scott just wanted to let me know that if I ever do get down to Australia, he wants me to come visit he and his students at Victoria University. And I am certainly going to try to do that. It's a big place to try to get to, but I'm going to try to make that plan eventually in the future. My wife and I, Australia is definitely one of our must-visit locations on the places we want to go around the world. And Scott, thank you for sending me that email. Anybody else out there that's a listener in Australia, I know I have quite a few listeners down there. You certainly are welcome to keep in touch with me. I'm hoping like in the next 3 to 4, maybe 5 years, we can try to save up and plan a trip like that, because it's something we really need to plan to get away and do. So when I get that opportunity, I certainly want to have some people on the inside that can help out with that. And Scott, thank you for your gracious offer. I am looking forward to anybody that'd like me to come meet with them when I'm on a trip, or even wants to, if they have a conference or something coming up, I certainly am always open to being a speaker at anything, talking about podcasting and EMS, talking about medical education using technology, something I'm very passionate about. And I'm certainly open to traveling anywhere that I can get there and try to spread the word. So if you have something like that coming up, certainly let me know. Finally, I got an email from listener Kelly, and Kelly is nice enough to send me an article link for an article talking about iron deficiency and pediatric stroke risk factors. Really good stuff. Kelly, thank you very much for sending me that article. And actually, like I said earlier, this is how I come up with ideas for what you guys want to hear about in the show. Articles and things that you all find interesting or are what I use for news items in the show, as well as tips and tricks and meds. So guess what we're going to be covering this week, folks? A little later on after the news, we'll be talking about anemia, different types of anemias, and also iron supplementation, both for people that are deficient in iron and also the product problems that deal with iron toxicity. And I'll have links for all of that, including Kelly's link later on in the Med of the Week. Kelly, thank you very much for sending me that. I'll move on to the link of the week very briefly. I already talked about it a little bit earlier when I was talking about Helen's email. And the link of the week this week is going to be for the Medicast Live this Tuesday night. And I'm sending out a call to anybody out there who is or ever has been a wilderness EMT or wilderness EMT paramedic. I'm really looking for somebody that can act as an expert. And you don't have to be the EMS instructor of the year to do this. An expert, as far as I'm concerned, is somebody who has knowledge of the topic area. And I'd really like to know about what you've done in Wilderness EMS, as well as get some input on what it takes to become a wilderness EMT, the program, what its focus is, those kind of things. So if you're able to participate and want to, head on over to medicastlive.com, or you can click on the link in the show notes and find out how to register for free. And I'm looking forward to having a big audience that we can field questions from and comments from this coming Tuesday night at 10 p.m. on the 13th of November. Okay, let's jump right on into this week's news. You know, it's interesting that we talk a lot about, you know, do we have more calls in the full moon? Do we have more calls at night than at day? Do the weird things happen at 3 a.m. as opposed to 3 p.m? We do a lot of conjecture over time and season and things like that. But I found an interesting study over at MSNBC.com that talks about an American Heart Association report that is saying that people who have chronic high blood pressure and are taking medications for that are harder to treat in the wintertime, that their blood pressure is harder to control in the wintertime. This is based on a 5-year study on blood pressure readings for over 400,000 military veterans in and around 15 different cities, from as far away as Anchorage, Alaska, down to San Juan, Puerto Rico. In each location, the researchers found that fewer of the veterans, regardless of their race or sex, returned to normal blood pressure levels when they were treated in the winter months when compared to the summer months. And there's a significant seasonal variation in all of the cities. So even in the time of, even in Puerto Rico, it may not have to do solely with the weather being warmer or colder in the winter months, but it may also have to do with sunlight levels. About 60% of the patients had a marked change in blood pressure control in the winter time. And also, they found that in the wintertime, people had less exercise, had more likely to gain weight. All of these things really could have contributed to the hypertension levels. So it's something to be aware of. This means we're more likely to see AMIs in the wintertime. We're more likely to see strokes in the wintertime. We're more likely to see a lot of different things in the wintertime, all based solely on a combination of factors going on during winter months. So it's something for people who have blood pressure issues to be aware of, and something you can pass on to your patients as a little tidbit of information backed up by some strong science that their blood pressure is going to be harder to keep track of in the wintertime, and maybe they should be monitoring it a little more stringently. Moving right along, I guess everybody knows that I'm a pretty strong supporter of AEDs in the community. And, you know, I think, heck, all EMS providers should be strong proponents of AEDs in their communities. So I was pretty interested when I found an article. Actually, there was a bunch of articles out this week on AEDs and CPR, but one article in particular really leapt out at me right away, and that is the article that said that the Federal Aviation Administration had banned AEDs from their flight control centers. All right, so we have our air traffic controllers, people who are engaged in a high-stress job that are likely to have that stress translate into higher blood pressures, maybe inability to get good diet in their lives, so they're higher risk for heart attack, and we're not going to have AEDs close by. The FAA is saying that they don't want defibrillators in their centers that don't have concurrent medical offices. So if there isn't a nurse's office or some kind of medical office attached to that particular center, they don't want AEDs there. This is for your smaller airports, and maybe your larger international airports may have an associated medical center because the staffing's large enough, but they don't have one in all of the airports where the aviation air traffic controllers are. So they don't have these defibrillators there. They don't want to have it because it's too hard to keep them in compliance and keep them checked and up to date. And I'm reading this article and my jaws, you can hear it like thunk, thunk, hitting the table every time I get to another paragraph, because it just doesn't make sense. If one of the people in one of these places went into cardiac arrest, one of the leaders of a local union said that they would have to run up and down 2 flights of stairs, cover about 80 yards to retrieve an AED, and then bring it back to the center through the same grueling obstacle course to try to get an AED back to this patient in time. Luckily, most airports do have AEDs on site, but they're all in the concourses where the patients of travelers are likely to be. This is something that's of concern to me because this is such an easy, life-saving thing to do. And AEDs are not hard to maintain. It can be done easily by partnering with the airport's own EMS people. If you have a smaller airport that doesn't have its own medical service somewhere in the airport, well, then fine. You can train one of your people as an EMT or first responder, get a local medical doctor to partner up with them, and they can do regular checks. It's simple as making sure the battery's charged, as the equipment's in date. This is not something that requires daily checks. This can be done and maintained easily by checking it once a week or once a month without having to go through a lot of hassle. So this kind of just shocked me. And I, you know, as people age, as people in high stress jobs become older and our population as a whole is aging, we are going to need AEDs in more and more locations. And I really honestly believe that the day will come when AEDs will be mandated by building code, just like sprinkler systems are. We're going to say, all right, you're a public building that has X number of people or more planned on visiting it on a regular basis. You need to have an AED in place. This means grocery stores. This means drug stores, not just shopping malls, not just wherever, churches, every place that has regular attendance by a group of people from the public are likely to have need for an AED at some point. So I think this is something we're going to see more and more of in the future. And good grief, the FAA needs to get off their butts and get this situation in gear. So how do I know that AEDs save lives? Well, okay, besides the obvious that, you know, a defibrillator is the definitive treatment for cardiac arrest, and without defibrillation, cardiac arrest survival is very unlikely. Of course, cardiac survival is unlikely anyway, right? Well, not necessarily. The American Heart Association had their annual meeting in Orlando, Florida, and they had numerous presentations of scientific studies looking at the recent 2005 update to CPR standards and BLS and ALS protocols, as well as the use of AEDs in the field. And they found that AED use coupled with CPR more than doubles a person's chances of surviving cardiac arrest in a non-hospital setting. The study was presented in Orlando this past week and looked at cases involving over 10,000 patients from 11 urban or rural communities in Canada and the United States, all of whom suffered out-of-hospital cardiac arrests during the course of 1 year. In these cases, 3,191 cases had bystander-administered CPR, just about 30%, and AED was used in the field in about 259 cases, which comes out to about 2.5%. The survival rate for patients who received CPR alone was 9%, compared with 36% for patients who received field CPR and AED shock. Now, after they adjusted this for factors that were going on in each case, the researchers found and concluded that CPR plus AED more than doubled chances of survival, raising the average survival rate, which means leaving the hospital, discharged from the hospital after a cardiac arrest, from about 7.5% to 15%. This is significant, folks, okay? This means that whatever your survival rate is in your community, and it's all different everywhere because you may be rural, you may be urban, whatever your survival rate is in your community, you can double it by teaching bystander CPR and having AEDs readily available in your community, either in the back of police cars or in public locations. All of these things can be out there available for people to use and improve cardiac arrest survival rates significantly. So FAA, check out this article about survival rates and the use of AEDs and wonder how much it costs to train somebody new after the old guy died because he didn't have an AED nearby. Well, I will wrap up the news this week with a look at another study that was presented in Orlando this past week, looking at the energy drinks that are out there. You know, it's really popular right now to drink the energy beverages where they have high levels of caffeine or taurine or other kinds of stimulants. Increasingly popular high caffeine beverages do more than just give you a jolt of energy. They also increase your heart rate and your blood pressure levels, and in some cases, significantly. Now, this is the result of a small study that was looked at to advise people who already have high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease to whether you should avoid those types of drinks. Do we need to counsel patients that this isn't a good idea to drink these things? Or remember ourselves if we are, in fact, ourselves dealing with high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease to not drink energy drinks because of the impacts on our blood pressures and may change the effectiveness of medications. The researchers found both significant increases in blood pressure and heart rate in healthy volunteers who were just sitting in a chair watching movies. They weren't doing anything. They weren't exercising. They weren't involved in work. They were just watching a movie in a resting state, and the increases were significant. Now, they weren't raising to dangerous levels, but this is a group of volunteers whose average age was 26, sitting watching a movie, drinking an energy drink. What happens if you're out in your job? What happens if you're having a really crappy day and your stress level is a mile high and your blood pressure's up anyway and you decide to take an energy drink because you need to stay up late? Well, guess what, folks? You're likely to increase your risk of heart attack or stroke or any other cardiovascular risk of an acute onset problem. So this is significant and something that needs to be looked at, and it might be something that we need to include in our history. Not only are we asking what medications they've taken, but we also need to say, hey, you know, what kind of things have you had to drink recently? Do you drink energy drinks or something like that? Do you drink high caffeine espresso or coffee? These kind of things can make a contribution when we get to the ER, passing that information along to the staff. And it's just good history-taking technique. The news is done, and it's now time to jump into this week's tip and trick of the week. As I said earlier, I'm going to be talking a little bit about anemia. I've talked about a specific type of anemia in the past. I think back in episode 25, I talked about sickle cell anemia, and I'll touch on that briefly again here. But I'm going to look at anemia as a general condition, and also anemia as what we can do to think about treating it based upon maybe some of the specific types of anemia that a patient might present with. Anemia is basically a condition in which a person's blood has a lower than normal number of red blood cells, or the red blood cells they have don't have enough hemoglobin content. Hemoglobin is an iron-rich protein that is the protein that gives red color to the blood. And in fact, the reason that venous blood is darker than arterial blood is the fact that the hemoglobin attaches the oxygen in the lungs, and it's that attached oxygen that gives blood its bright red color. When the hemoglobin has the oxygen detached from it, it actually does not have the red color. This is how we have the change that we can look at in pulse ox. When you put that little red light and shine it through somebody's finger or through their earlobe or something, we are actually looking at the color of the blood, and using the electronic monitoring in that device monitors the color of the blood and the changes in the oxygenation of that blood. Of course, a person with anemia is not going to have normal pulse ox readings, and that may not be indicative of a specific problem, so we need to remember that. I'm not going to go into a lot about blood composition. That's another whole topic, but just an understanding of what anemia is either a lack of red blood cells or red blood cells normal in number but lacking hemoglobin content. So these are red blood cells that are pale in color. There are many different types of anemia, and I'll just briefly touch on all of them here. First of all, the most common type of anemia are iron deficiency anemias. And these anemias basically are just what they say. These patients have a deficiency of iron in their diet, either because they don't take in enough iron or because of another disease process in their body that either inhibits their absorption of iron or has depleted their body's stores of iron. Either way, these patients, the simple treatment is to increase their iron levels in their blood by giving them iron supplementation. And I'll talk a little bit more about iron supplementation later in this episode as the med of the week. Other types of anemia include the genetic disorders that cause anemia. One of them I already talked about briefly, sickle cell anemia. And remember, that is where the blood cells are curved or crescent shaped. They are not as elastic as they need to be. And when going through single file through the capillaries, they actually get clogged up, backed up, and caused localized necrosis of the tissues because of lack of efficient blood flow there. And that's what sickle cell anemia's primary cause is. And of course, the way to treat that is to increase fluid, increase the amount of vasodilation in the periphery, and also oxygenation to increase the oxygen that is getting out to the peripheral tissues during a crisis in sickle cell disease. Other types of genetic disorders also include thalassemia. Thalassemia is a disease that is common in certain populations around the Mediterranean and North Africa and Arab populations. And this is a disorder where the hemoglobin itself is missing key proteins. Based on the type of thalassemia you have, you would be missing a certain protein that goes with the hemoglobin molecule, and therefore your hemoglobin is not able to work as efficiently based on that problem. And thalassemia is also known as Cooley's disease, so you may see that out there as well as another name. Other types of anemia include the aplastic anemias, and this is a disease in the bone marrow where the bone marrow itself is not producing red blood cells, either completely or in various levels of lack of production. And this is all based on that you're going to have actually a shortage of a lot of different types of blood cells, but they are also anemic based on their inability to carry enough oxygen because of their shortage. And this is a very serious life-threatening condition, either caused at birth through a genetic abnormality, growth abnormality of the fetus, or also may be caused by certain disease processes. Things like leukemia can be a cause of aplastic anemia. So those are some of the different anemias out there. There's another one that's called pernicious anemia. Pernicious anemia is specifically related to a lack of B12 in your diet because vitamin B12 is needed to form red blood cells and hemoglobin. And this is something that's commonly seen in people who are vegetarians. They don't get enough B12 because B12 is really something that's found most often in the iron-rich blood of animals. And so if you don't eat animal products in your diet, specifically meat, you're not going to get enough B12. Not usually a problem for most people, but it's very common in vegetarian populations. One common cause of iron deficiency is a loss of red blood cells faster than the body can reproduce and create more, or depletion of the iron stores because of blood loss. Now, of course, anything that causes a blood loss is going to cause a potential for anemia. In a healthy person, you can lose some blood even in some kind of relatively major trauma and replenish those blood stores yourself over time with proper diet and rest, fluid hydration, things like that during your recovery process. But certain populations are more at risk. Women of childbearing age, both due to blood loss from menstruation and during childbirth, are at higher risk for being anemic. Also, older adults who have medical conditions may be at risk for anemia, and younger children, children younger than 2 years, because of, again, immature body systems still not at their full potential, cannot properly make enough blood or store the materials needed to produce blood efficiently. So these populations are at higher risk. People with poor or inadequate diets that are low in iron, vitamins, or key minerals are also at risk. Blood loss from surgery or recent injury, chronic serious illnesses, kidney disease, cancer, diabetes, people who have rheumatoid arthritis, any kind of inflammatory disease like your inflammatory bowel disease, arthritis, HIV, and AIDS all can be making you at higher risk for anemia and chronic infections. Anything that really affects the body's ability to function properly is going to have a long-term effect on the production and support of the blood supply. And so all of these things are really cascading in effect. The good news is you can treat anemia patients, whether in the field or in the hospital. A treatment of patients who are at risk for anemia is easy. You can monitor their blood levels. You can monitor their pulse ox. Give them oxygen. Give them iron supplementation if you're involved in long-term care, and also provide them adequate fluid to move the iron they have around their bodies. Signs and symptoms of a patient with a chronic anemia problem or even acute anemia, perhaps shortness of breath, dizziness, headache. They may have cold extremities, cold hands and feet, pale skin, and also chest pain. All of these are signs and symptoms that are showing that they're having trouble getting oxygen-rich blood around the body. Let's move on into the med of the week and look at how iron fits into this whole picture. First of all, we can look at a couple of things. The most common form of anemia is iron deficiency anemia. And so that's where we come back to listener Kelly's link. She sent me a link on some Canadian researchers who have looked at an alarming link between iron deficiency in children and strokes. Now, children really, unless they have some other underlying disease process, should not be getting strokes. Strokes are related to cardiovascular disease, long-term effects of just living life, whether you're healthy or not. In other ways, life eventually deteriorates parts of your body. But children are healthy and all their body parts are relatively brand new. But what the researchers in Canada found when looking at childhood strokes was that all of the children, or a significant portion of the children involved in these strokes, had iron deficiency. And that's a large group. So this is a completely preventable problem. And if you can stop the relatively few strokes from happening in young children by just making sure they have enough iron in their diet, why not do so? So I have a link in the show notes for all of that. I'll provide two other links in the show notes, one from emsresponder.com that speaks specifically about the pre-hospital iron toxicity problems, and also emedicine.com, which has a little broader scope look at iron toxicity and will give you some outlook on prevention, on long-term prognosis, and on in-hospital and immediately post-hospital treatment of iron toxicity. It's important, though, to first start out and talk a little bit about where iron is coming from in our diets. Iron is an essential nutrient. It's an essential component in the formulation of hemoglobin, which is the product that carries oxygen in our blood cells from the lungs to the rest of the body's tissues. Without iron, our body loses its ability to transport oxygen efficiently and therefore contributes to hypoxia in the tissues and eventually death. Iron can be gotten through numerous sources, both iron supplementation using things like ferrous sulfate tablets, as well as iron in our diets from sources like the leafy green vegetables like kale, spinach. Also, iron is present in potatoes and also red meat. So what do we do with our iron diets? Well, if we don't have enough iron in our diet, or if we have a contributing problem that is causing us to lose red blood cells faster than we normally would, then we may need to increase the amount of iron in our diet. And so some people in our communities or in our homes are going to have need for iron supplementation. Iron is not easily absorbed by our bodies. Iron that comes from animal products is more easily absorbed than iron that comes from vegetable products or from supplements. There are some things we can do to both discourage and encourage the absorption of iron. Milk products from cow's milk primarily is a key component in the lack of ability to absorb iron in children. Children who receive abundant amounts of cow's milk or are drinking too much cow's milk in a day can have a problem absorbing iron. and cow's milk does not have iron in it. So I don't want to say that you shouldn't be taking your dairy products seriously, especially in children and adolescents, because of course, adequate dairy products also means adequate calcium intake. But again, all things in moderation. Some things also will aid in absorption. One of these is vitamin C, which you find in citrus fruits, broccoli, strawberries, cabbages. All of these also help the body to absorb iron. So there's things that help and things that don't help the absorption process. When a person needs supplementation, though, that means there's some form of iron vitamin, iron tablets in the home. And when this happens, either in an elderly patient who may be taking supplementation because of an underlying illness, they may take too much of their iron. They may forget they already took it and take additional iron and can start to overload their systems. And also in young children who may get into pill bottles, they can quickly ingest a fatal dose of iron. And when this happens, rapid treatment and transport is indicated because there are only a few things we can do to slow and stop the absorption of a fatal dose of iron. The body possesses limited ways to store and also to excrete iron. And this is involving key proteins. If there is not enough of these key proteins present to absorb and hold on to the iron, then the iron quickly becomes built up in the liver. And the liver will have inflammation, may possibly develop tissue necrosis or fibrosis in the liver related to the iron buildup. And eventually this can lead to death. So we need to stop the absorption of the iron. So prevention is a key problem here, a key task, I guess. And also, once in place, rapid identification of the problem and treatment is indicated. Signs and symptoms of iron overdose or iron toxicity include abdominal cramping, blackening of the stools, diarrhea, constipation, nausea, and vomiting. Iron is very toxic to the body's tissues and is very irritating to the GI tract. So patients who have ingested a lot of iron or have over time been ingesting a lot of iron that you might see in, say, an elderly patient who's taking the wrong dose may be evidenced in GI bleeding. Increased GI bleeds, signs of anemia related to blood loss, not related to an iron deficiency. There are different phases of iron poisoning. The first phase occurs in the first few hours after ingestion and involves the gastric disturbances I just talked about. They can include the vomiting, the diarrhea, abdominal pain. Eventually, the iron supplement will disintegrate, and eventually they will have a dark coloring to vomit or a darkening of the stools. As the iron begins to be absorbed, even in the limited ability of the body to absorb iron, enough of it will start to get into the bloodstream that the liver will begin to release enzymes, causing blood vessels to begin to dilate. You will see a lowering in blood pressure. You may also see signs of lethargy or even coma. The blood will also become rapidly acidic, and the victim may begin having some kind of seizure-like activity. The second phase of iron toxicity begins about 6 to 12 after the ingestion of the iron, and in this symptom, you'll see similar symptoms to the first, but again, the later symptoms are more in evidence as the iron begins to be more fully taken in by the liver. Again, you're going to see lowering of blood pressure, possibility of increased metabolic acidosis, and seizure-like activity. In this situation, patients sometimes are sent home and haven't had the second phase fully set in yet because the patient was thought to have recovered and not as ingested as much as was suspected. So again, this can happen up to 12, maybe 48 hours later. And this is a long time when you think you've gotten through the worst of it. Third phase of iron toxicity is where you have the highest mortality rate and is indicated by onset of severe shock, liver cell damage that is often irreversible, and liver cell necrosis. A decrease in the blood coagulation, low blood sugar, and renal failure. All of this more likely related to the metabolic acidosis that is going on. And eventually, people will eventually progress into the fourth phase if they survive the third phase of iron toxicity. And this usually happens about 2 to 5 weeks after the initial overdose. And this is where they will develop GI tract obstructions, and including pain, constipation, and nausea and vomiting. And they need to be monitored carefully for this because of the possibility of GI obstruction and necrosis of the intestinal tract. In our setting, in the pre-hospital setting, we are likely to be treating this patient by getting a good patient history and a thorough physical exam. If the patient is taking iron supplements and you're seeing signs that might indicate an iron overdose, you want to talk to the patient or their caregiver about exactly how many pills they're taking. Perhaps the bottle was either mislabeled or the patient misunderstood the labeling. Either way, you can quickly identify if there's a possibility this may be an overdose. In the labs in the hospital, they will check the serum iron levels and be able to find out if that serum iron toxicity is indeed going on. But you can start the ball rolling by getting a good patient history and help the doctors and nurses find a better way, get a little bit farther down the path of diagnosing the patient by getting a good history in the field. Again, they don't get to see the home. They don't get to see all the meds. And you identifying that this patient's taking iron supplements as well as other prescribed medications may be where you can get a little bit of a head start on this. Don't discount the box of vitamins sitting on the kitchen table. Just because they hand you 3 medicine bottles out of the medicine cabinet, ask them, hey, what of these are you taking, when you point to the vitamin bottles. Additional treatment is really going to have to be continued in the hospital setting, but initially go ahead and get IV started. You can start at KVO, but be prepared to deal with an onset of hypotension and be ready with a fluid bolus if necessary. You also want to monitor the airway, make sure they're breathing effectively, all of the things you should be doing anyway, but be aware that there could be an onset of shock in these patients if this was the day that the dose became toxic to the level that they're going to progress into longer and higher phases of the iron toxicity problem. In the hospital, the treatment is really going to revolve around chelation therapy. Chelation therapy is giving a medication that helps the body to absorb toxic metals and excrete those metals either in the renal kidney system and urinary tract, or excrete those things by way of the gastrointestinal tract. Chelation therapy is something you'll see in lead poisoning cases, and there are medications that will bind the iron as well as other metals that are out there. So chelation therapy is where the treatment is likely to go. And they can definitively diagnose the iron toxicity using ongoing lab reports and lab effectiveness. Some of the meds you're likely to see for chelation therapy include deferoxamine, desferol, also deferrox or Xjade, and you may also be administering laxative agents like polyethylene glycol bowel preparation in the hospital, which has a laxative effect as well as electrolytic and osmotic effects, which may help clear iron out of the GI tract before it can be absorbed. After these treatments, patients will need to be monitored. Again, the extensive phases involved in iron toxicity mean that they really need to be followed for several weeks following the incident, so that there can be follow-up lab studies and follow-up treatments as necessary. And that is a quick look at iron toxicity. Follow the links. There's a lot more information at both of these links for iron toxicity. Okay, I guess that's going to wrap up another episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for joining the show. And I want to thank Kelly for the ideas for this week's Tip of the Week and Med of the Week. I certainly appreciate it. If you have any comments, any corrections of anything I may have misspoken, or anything else you'd like to add to the show, questions for future episodes, go ahead and catch up with me here by email at podmedic@mac.com, or you can go over to the website directly at mediccast.com, and over at the blog there, you can leave a comment in the bottom of any of the blog posts there. Just click on the comments link at the bottom of each article, and it will take you to a page where you can either log in, or if you haven't done so before, go ahead and you can sign up for a registration for free for the MedicCast, which will get you the ability to go ahead and comment directly on the site. Your initial comment will take up to 24 hours to show up because I have to approve all of that. But once that process is done, you can go ahead and comment almost immediately. If you'd like to reach me by phone, you can call me in the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. I'll close out the show, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music. This is an artist we've played before here on the MedicCast by the name of Johanna Staley, and I consider her a friend of the show. I'll let her introduce her own music here towards the end, and she has a little message for the rest of you. But this is a song called I'm Not Perfect, one of my favorites of hers. If you like what you hear, you can head on over to her website, let her know that you heard it here on the MedicCast. And if you're interested, I also have a link in the show notes where you can go ahead and purchase her music directly via iTunes if you'd like to do so. Either way, this is a great song and leads me to end the show as I always do by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time. Scene Safety, BSI.
Hi, this is Johanna Staley, and you're about to listen to some music from my CD, I'm Not Perfect. I want to thank you guys for making such a difference. Keep up the good work.
Take that, I take it back. You can hold me down, but I'm